Monday of June already.
That's amazing. The summer's already flying by.
It really, really is, I guarantee you. Beautiful day outside right now. I haven't pulled up the weather, but I will do that right quick. Looks like kind of a Chamber of Commerce morning out there anyway. We're setting at 73 degrees today. Should top out in the upper 80s, low 90s. Boy, yesterday wasn't bad at all. A little humid, but a little cool breeze. Had that rain around us, but I kind of miss the rain. How about you?
I do, too. I thought maybe we'd get a little bit yesterday. Those clouds were building up. We live outside of Abernathy, and it was nice sitting on the front porch watching the breeze and the clouds, and it's a good day.
Like I say, we got a little bit of sprinkle, but that's about it. Not near enough to write home about, that's for sure. So, anyhow, it is good to have you with us, and believe it or not, I'm going to let you talk this week. Last week, it was, I mean, you sat down and we started talking about, I'm not sure we wasn't kin to each other before the show was over. We might have been, but anyhow.
Well, it's good to know where you came from and for the listeners to know where I've come from, because it kind of, to me, helps make it a little more clear of why I'm doing what I'm doing. And because what I am doing is a little bit different. It's not the norm as far as most conventional doctors go. I think it's the future of medicine. It's what Thomas Edison 100 years ago said. All doctors of the future will learn about diet, nutrition, you know, basically stewarding your health through proper diet is what he said.
Well,
but
doctor, didn't that the way it used to be back years ago when we had one doctor and he had know a little bit about it. Don't get me wrong. I'm not running. Well, we need what we have. We need the specialist and all that. You don't want to do heart surgery down there in your clinic, I don't think.
No. We need some conventional docs for sure. The problem is most of our doctors, most of our healthcare dollars, most of our energy, most of our everything is spent trying to manage chronic disease, diabetes, obesity, congestive heart failure, coronary artery disease, stroke, cancer. I mean, all these chronic things. Not, you know, traumas. I'm all for a good trauma surgeon, orthopedic surgeons. And I think part of the problem is at some point in the past, we started thinking there's this one pill for one symptom kind of deal. You know, way back in the day, we recognized physical ailments as a deficiency. For example, scurvy. I mean, scurvy, swollen gums and bleeding and all this stuff. And, I mean, it would look like a disease, quote unquote, until we figured out, oh, it's just a lack of vitamin C.
Yeah.
And so this disease was really a deficiency of vitamin C. So no problem. You give vitamin C and that disease goes away. Same thing with rickets way back in the day. I mean, all these broken bones are much more brittle bones. And we figured out, oh, it's a lack of vitamin D. So therefore, just give the vitamin D and this disease, quote unquote, goes away. So, I mean, we easily see
right,
that
let me
now.
Let me stop you right. I don't mean to stop. All right, you said take the vitamins, absolutely. All right, is the one-a-day vitamin, does that have enough, or do we need to go to the straight D, straight C?
Most of the daily, kind of especially the over-the-counter store-brand type of things, don't have enough vitamin D.
That's...
In my experience, most of my adult patients need at the minimum 5,000 international units of vitamin D a day. Most multivitamins I've looked at have anywhere from 800 to 1,000, maybe 2,000, but that's rare. And most of my patients start at 5,000. Many of my patients need 8 to 10,000. A lot of on vitamin D3. And it's best to get it in combination with vitamin K2. Vitamin K2 is what's going to tell your body to put that calcium to the bone and the teeth. Because otherwise, if you take a higher dose vitamin D, you're going to hold on to calcium a little more aggressively. And that calcium could just end up anywhere in the body. It could calcify your carotid artery. It could calcify make a kidney stone, make a heel spur, you know, whatever. But you need that calcium to go to the bone, and vitamin K2 is what tells it to go to the bone. And I think vitamin K2 is probably, it's kind of the stealth vitamin, I call it. You know, about 10 years ago, we started understanding vitamin D3.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the cutting-edge doctors started really pushing it and preaching it, and it took about 10 years, and it's still not, I don't know that even a lot of mainstream doctors don't necessarily look at it or know enough about it, but it's becoming more mainstream. But I think vitamin K2 is the next one.
Now,
10
is
years
K2
from now,
available over the counter?
Yes.
Just like, okay.
Yes, it is. And I think 10 years from now, everybody's going to be understanding it and how important it is. to help prevent osteoporosis and help prevent the calcification of your arteries.
Really?
I mean, it's a very important vitamin. And normally it will come out of your intestines. Your bacteria in the gut lining, the probiotics, will produce K2 along with lots of other things they produce. Those probiotics in the gut are exceedingly important. They produce, for example, it's about 20,000 different enzymes that they make to break down your food, specifically the carbohydrates and starches in your food, like the vegetables. The human body only makes about 17 or 18 enzymes that can break down these starches that are in your vegetables. It's the gut bacteria that make the other 20,000 enzymes to break down your food so that your body can use it. So it's a symbiotic relationship we have with the bugs in our gut. And if we start decimating the gut flora, then we start losing a lot of the ability to digest our food. We lose the ability to make vitamin K2. We lose the ability to make other vitamins and nutrients. The gut flora is exceedingly important. And I think that's one of the primary reasons we've seen this astronomical exponential rise in chronic disease the past 30, 40 years. A big part, I believe, is due to the gut flora that's totally wiped out. And there's doctors that have studied the gut flora of humans in Western society. Mm-hmm. When you look at ancient tribes like the African Maasai tribe in Africa, the South American Peru Indians that live in the Amazon, when you study their gut flora, they've got 20,000 to 30,000 species, different species of bugs in the gut, of bacteria in the gut. When you look at an average American, we're somewhere around 5,000. That's if you're healthy. A chronically sick average American gut flora population is down to like 400 to maybe 1,000, somewhere in that range. So we're missing this huge variety of gut bacteria. And when you miss those guys, you start to miss a whole lot of biochemistry in the body. I was doing a presentation the other day. I'll pull it up here on my iPad real quick to give you some of the details. But the presentation was about the gut flora, and in particular, what all the gut flora does for the human body. We found four different strains of gut bacteria that help break down different pesticides that are in our food. Everyone's so worried about the pesticides, and I would be too. They kill the gut flora. But these bacteria can help break those down. There was another study that showed BPA, that's the plastic residue. It acts like estrogen in the human body, so it disrupts fertility, it disrupts sperm count, it disrupts just normal menstrual cycles. So they showed these different gut bacteria that would actually break down the BPA so that we don't have to be, you know, as worried or as scared about that. There was another study that showed a particular level of bacteria was increased in kids with asthma. So there's an imbalance of these bacteria in the gut, and they had too much of a certain bacteria, and it increased their risk of asthma. There was a doctor down in Australia that showed one particular probiotic strain called Lactobacillus rhamnosus. When he gave this probiotic strain back to these kids with a peanut allergy, so these are real, you know, anaphylactic type shock, need an EpiPen, bad peanut allergy. 80% of those kids with the bad peanut allergy resolved their peanut allergy, had no more peanut allergy with one strain, by reintroducing one strain of bacteria called Lactobacillus rhamnosus. Another study, I really like this one. It's in regards to multiple sclerosis, autoimmune disease. They showed an increased number of a certain gut bacteria type that was known to hyperstimulate the immune system. So autoimmune diseases, autoimmune, your own immune system is attacking yourself. And that may manifest in your joints, and we call it rheumatoid arthritis. It may manifest in your neurological system. We call that MS. It can manifest in your gut, and we call it celiac. But for MS, this particular study showed that the immune system was being hyperstimulated by an overproduction of a particular gut bacteria. So when we do things that are not beneficial to the gut, some bacteria get wiped out, other bacteria have room to grow and overgrow too much, and we lose the balance. This study went on to look at countries that had lower rates of multiple sclerosis, in particular the country of India, and they looked at the gut flora of the India population. But then they looked at immigrants who were born in India, lived in India, didn't have MS, and then they moved to America. They watched them over time, and their gut flora changed to American gut flora, and their MS rates rose to the same rates as the American population. We've seen that with breast cancer in the Japanese women. Very little breast cancer in Japan, but you watch the immigrants come to America, you watch them for 20 years, their breast cancer rates go right up to American rates. Another real interesting gut flora study, I'm kind of whipping through these quickly, but just to give you some examples of how important this gut flora is, there's a study that showed vitamin C can be made by one particular strain of bacteria in the gut. You know, most mammals can make vitamin C, you know, horses, dogs, cats, pretty much all of them, except I think guinea pigs and one other, and humans. We're missing one of the genes to make vitamin C. But other mammals, when they're sick or when they're stressed, they start ramping up their vitamin C production big time. And you typically don't see these animals, you know, have chronic disease or even acute disease very much. So, but humans can't make vitamin C, but the gut bacteria do. So that was a very interesting new study. Another study, 94 different strains. This was from May of 14. 94 different strains of gut bacteria shown to break down gluten. Now, gluten is a big topic, you know, these days, gluten-free this and gluten-free that. Here's my take on gluten. The way God made gluten, I think we've talked about this before, the wheat that God made, the ancient wheat called einkorn wheat, which is what we made our blueberry muffins out of this weekend, einkorn flour, that wheat stood about 4 or 5 foot tall. And it only had 14 chromosomes. So the genetic material that was in that wheat was pretty minimal. And the gluten that was in that original God wheat, this particular gluten is not very pro-inflammatory. So that was the original wheat. And over the years, it got hybridized and hybridized kind of mixed, different breeds mixed together. In 1970, Norman Borlaug really did some hybridization with it, and he won the Nobel Prize for curing world hunger.
I had the opportunity to sit and interview him twice.
Really?
Back in the day. Yes,
yeah.
Mr. Borlaug, what a great man.
Well, I was introduced to his work by Dr. William Davis, who's a cardiologist out of Wisconsin, who wrote a book called Wheat Belly, and he was analyzing this exponential rise in disease from specifically coronary disease because he's a cardiologist. Mm-hmm. And what he started looking at was Dr. Borlaug's work when he hybridized the wheat. So it went from that 4 foot tall ancient wheat to what we call dwarf wheat, about 18 inches tall. And dwarf wheat's great for, you know, production because it's drought resistant, mm-hmm. wind resistant, everything resistant, I think. And you get like 10 times the yield per acre. So on the surface looks great. You know, you get more yield, you can feed more people. And this is, you know, Nobel Prize material, which it was. He won the Nobel Prize. But what Dr. Davis showed was the starch content of that wheat got changed. Amylopectin A and amylopectin B. These are two different starch molecules of the wheat, and when he hybridized it, it changed the ratio of that of the amylopectin A and B, and he changed it up. Well, I mean, he didn't do this intentionally, but this is just one of the unintended consequences. There's a whole lot more amylopectin A, and the problem with that is your saliva breaks that down very, very quickly into blood sugar. So within 5 seconds of chewing on that whole wheat pasta or whole wheat bread or whole wheat anything, you're changing that starch into sugar, into glucose. So you're raising your blood sugar within seconds of chewing on that new wheat, and therefore you're spiking your insulin. Anytime you raise sugar, you raise insulin. Insulin's your fat storage hormone. Insulin's a inflammatory, pro-inflammatory hormone. So there's a lot of issues with that. But what I'm getting at, back to the study, 94 different strains of gut bacteria can break down gluten. But most of the sensitivity that people have today is to the new gluten. The new wheat today has 46 chromosomes as opposed to 14. So it's all this new gluten that wasn't in the original wheat that people react to. But these gut bacteria will break it down. So nourish your gut flora is what I'm trying to, the point I'm trying to make.
Doctor, I believe we have a phone call. Let's go out the line. Good morning, caller.
Good morning.
I
had a question for Dr. Edwards here about gut health and mental health. And I think a lot of times people, it seems like the information that links your gut health and what happens in your gut to your mental health, there's not a lot of awareness about that. And anytime I am talking to somebody that's having mental health problems, I always ask them about their diet, and it's always terrible. You know, it's the sad diet. So what comments do you have on mental health and as it relates to gut health, Dr. Edwards?
Okay, thanks for that call.
I appreciate that call. That's a very good call.
Great topic. We see a lot of mental health issues ourselves, whether it's just anxiety and insomnia, all the way to ADD, ADHD, autism, schizophrenia, anything in between. A very interesting book by Dr. Natasha McBride. She's an MD in London, and she wrote this book a few years ago because her own kids had some neurological or mental psychological issues. I believe it was ADHD and maybe some dyslexia. I don't recall if it was autism spectrum or not. But bottom line, she started researching all this gut flora and gut health and came to this conclusion that the gut and the brain are connected. And in fact, they're very connected as an embryo in the very, you know, first days and weeks of where when that sperm fertilized the egg, the neurological material breaks in half. Half of your nervous system goes to the gut, and half of that nervous system went up to the head to make the central nervous system, your brain, your spine. But the other half went down to the gut. And in medical school, we learned it to be the second brain of the human body, and it's called the enteric nervous system. And it's this bundle of nerves in the gut that is highly influenced by your gut health, the gut bacteria, the food that you eat. And so there's this relationship neurologically between the gut and the brain. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's more neurological information sent from your gut to your brain than there is from your brain to your gut. That takes a minute to get your head around that one. More neurological information sent from your gut to your brain than there is from your brain to your gut. So there's a vast richness and wealth of information influenced by the gut bacteria and the food. So neurotransmitters, serotonin, dopamine, melatonin, a lot of these neurotransmitters are actually made in the gut. I believe it's 80% of your serotonin is made in the gut. Serotonin is kind of your mood stabilizing chemical. So you go to your doctor with complaints of depression. I'm sad all the time. I'm unmotivated. I can't get out of bed. I don't want to eat. I don't want to do anything. I cry for no reason. I've lost my appetite. Or anxiety. You're just anxious for no reason. Then you'll be labeled major depressive disorder or generalized anxiety disorder. But remember, these are just labels, just like rickets and scurvy were labels, but it turned out to be just a deficiency. Same thing with these psychological diseases. They're labels based on certain groups of symptoms that you have. But what you'll be prescribed is a pill called a serotonin reuptake inhibitor. Basically what that does, it's a chemical in a pill that causes your serotonin hormone in the brain to try to be a little more active and have a little more effect. Basically, there's a deficiency of serotonin in the brain. So Zoloft, Lexapro, Prozac, all these serotonin pills. Well, the gut is where God gave us our own pharmacy, and primarily it's the gut and the liver. So we make our own serotonin, 80% of it in the gut. So what Natasha McBride, the doctor in London, figured out was all this relationship between the gut flora, the bacteria in the gut, how that bacteria talks to not only the enteric nervous system, but even our brain, our central nervous system. The gut flora, the bugs in the gut, are part of the production pathway of serotonin, melatonin, dopamine. For those things to be produced, you have to have the gut flora. And on top of that, the raw materials to make serotonin. You need amino acids. Those are the building blocks for serotonin. Well, amino acids come from your steak, your hamburger, your salmon, your chicken. You know, meat, protein, has these amino acids. So how do you break down that steak into amino acids? How do you turn your hamburger patty into an amino acid? Stomach acid. Hydrochloric acid in your stomach has to break and chop up that hamburger to get it down to amino acids so you can have the building blocks, the ingredients to make serotonin. Well, stomach acid production is on the decline in America. I mean, it is a rampant problem. Two big reasons why. There's multiple reasons. Here's the two biggest I see in my clinic. Stress and a high sugar diet. Those two things shut off your stomach acid production significantly. Stress, when you're in fight or flight mode, I think we've talked about this before. We're supposed to be at peace all the time. Rest and digest, we call it, versus fight or flight. When that bear comes across your path, you know, you go into fight or flight mode for 5 or 10 minutes so you can run away from the bear or kill the bear. So when you're in fight or flight mode, that's called sympathetic dominance. Your sympathetic nervous system turns on. So your pupils will dilate. Your heart rate will go up. You start to breathe a little more. All the blood gets shunted to those organs, your heart, your lung, your brain, and your muscles, so you can be ready to fight or flight. Your body doesn't care about digesting your last meal during that 5 minutes it's trying to survive that bear attack. Mm-hmm. So it basically shuts the digestive system down. Your body doesn't care about fighting infection in that 5 minutes of fight or flight, so it shuts your immune system down. So you kind of shunt all your energies and blood flow to these vital systems to fight or flight. And part of that's your stomach acid. You shut 50% of your pumps, your stomach acid pumps, off when you're in fight or flight mode. Now, that's fine if you're in fight or flight mode just, you know, for 5 minutes,
sure,
once in a blue moon. Most of our patients, though, turn out they're in fight or flight mode every single day, 24/7, because of all the stressors in our world. So our stomach acid production is compromised. We don't break down the foods like we should. That creates a whole cascade of events, one of which is not breaking proteins down, therefore not being able to make the serotonin. So you got to have the raw materials to make serotonin. You got to have the bacteria in the gut because they are part of the chemical process to produce, to turn that amino acid into serotonin. So gut health is, I don't believe anybody can get healthy mentally.
Probiotics.
Until their gut's healthy. Yeah. Probiotics, where do I stand on that?
We see so much on TV about that. It's thrown in our face all the time.
Yep. Well, probiotics.
Yes, your opinion on that.
And that's what I'm getting, you know, started the show with. The Maasai tribe in Africa has 20,000 different species of probiotics, just like we have dachshunds and golden retrievers and German shepherds. We're supposed to have 20,000 species of these probiotics in our gut. And most Americans, because of the way we eat and our chemical exposure, we're down to 5,000 at best. The sick Americans are down to 500. So that probiotics are exceedingly, exceedingly beneficial. The problem with a store-bought probiotic is even the best ones, you're getting maybe 10 strains. 12, I think 24 is the most I've ever seen strains of probiotic in a bottle. So it's limited. It's very limited in what it can do. Now, it can do a lot, especially in a really sick person who has no flora,
sure,
who is super inflamed. It turns out part of your immune system cells called dendritic cells, they have these little finger-like projections that stick out into the lumen of your gut, into the inside of your intestinal tube. So these immune cells kind of put their fingers out into your intestine to kind of test the waters and see what's going on out there. And when you put a good amount of probiotic supplement in, these probiotics can calm down. They interact with that dendritic nerve cell and immune system cell in the gut and tell the immune system, calm down, calm down, calm down. So it can have a calming effect on the immune system. So your autoimmune patients usually do really well on probiotics. It also can influence your digestive function and your bowels, regulate the bowels, stuff like that. However, studies have shown that probiotics in a pill don't really change your overall flora makeup. You can't get from 500 species back to 20,000 species by taking a pill. So they're of benefit. We use them in my clinic, but I'm using them less and less and less because of another product that I've recently learned about at a conference that I think is even better. We can talk about that in a minute if you want to.
Yes. Do have a text in if you'd like to read this and read that. This comes in from Jennifer. Said, I'm taking the D3 K2 supplement that your nurse practitioner has me on, and my mom, who is a nurse, keeps telling me you can get too much vitamin D, that your body doesn't get rid of it. Will you explain your view on this, please? And thank you.
Okay. I will gladly do that. Real quick before we move to that topic. I don't know if I mentioned the name of Dr. McBride's book for those who want to know more about the gut health and psychological health. It's called Gut and Psychology Syndrome is the name of her book. It's a great read. She has a diet called the GAPS diet. I think the website is gapsdiet.com. That's GAPS, like the clothing store, GAPS. So just, and Dr. Perlmutter, he's a neurologist, Grain Brain, Brain Maker, two of his books, just outstanding books that talk about mental health and the gut health and the connection between those. To the question on the vitamin D3, excuse me, you can get too much vitamin D3, but I've never known anyone to do it because the reason is we're so deficient and the body's so good at utilizing and breaking that down. There's a Dr. Stoss in Germany. He uses a protocol called the Stoss protocol, and he does upwards of 500,000 to 600,000 IUs of vitamin D per day. Every single day for his cancer protocol. So we're talking 30, 60 days of 500,000 every day with known proven toxicity yet. Now, if someone were doing that high dose in a cancer protocol, of course, there's things we watch. We look at the calcium levels. We look at the parathyroid hormone levels. These are things that have to be tracked. So I'm not suggesting you do this on your own. But in regards to using 5,000 a day, that's minimum dose. I mean, even the American Pediatric Society came out, I believe it was last year, year before, saying newborns, babies, one-year-olds, two-year-old kids need 800 IUs a day. 1,000 IUs a day. I mean, grade school kids, 2,000 for sure.
Now, this is the vitamin D3.
D3, 2,000 IUs a day in grade school kids.
Really?
And that's what's in your basic multivitamin. So no disrespect to the mama of the caller or the texter who texted. A lot of the nurses aren't informed. A lot of the doctors aren't informed. We weren't taught the proper things. But bottom line, just check your blood level. If you're below 50 on your blood level of vitamin D, you're too low. So take more. And like I've said, over 4 years of doing this and 4,000 or 5,000 patients, what I'm telling you is in West Texas, and these are farmers, ranchers, oil field workers, you know, people have been in the sun, they need 5,000 a day minimum. And a lot of my patients need 8,000 a day. So, but bottom line, stay on your D3 with K2. Just go check your level periodically and you'll start to learn what you need personally. But I can tell you almost guaranteed it'll be at least 5,000 a day.
Do we, when you... And then we'll go to a break. Do we, when we go see you or any other doctor and they do blood work, do they commonly check for vitamin D, B?
No, I don't know if I'd say it's common yet. More and more doctors are learning this. I first learned about it when I was down in Garza County about 6 or 7 years ago because I was listening to AM. It may have been this station. I don't know.
I don't want to give you the big head real quick, but I talked to a lot of people in last week, and I found out where you were from and all that, and they said, would you please come back?
Yeah, well.
You left them, I'm putting it this way, you left on very high standards.
Well, thank you. I love Garza County. The Lord put me on this new path, though. But I will tell you, I learned about vitamin D in Garza County because all those oil field workers, farmers, and ranchers, they're in the sun all day. I was checking their level, and they were still low. They were in the teens, and I thought, what in the world? And then I learned. Vitamin D is made when the sun hits your skin. The cholesterol in your skin produces the vitamin D, but it's a fat-soluble vitamin. So it sits in the oil of your skin, and it takes about 24 hours for that oil to soak in that has the vitamin D in it to soak into the deeper layers of your skin and be incorporated into your body. And everybody's bathing with soap less than every 24 hours or at least every 24 hours and washing that oil off. So even though they're in the sun a lot, they were coming home and bathing every night to get all the dirt and oil field grime off of them. They're washing off their vitamin D. I remember one gentleman, one farmer one time, his level was like 65 or 70 of his vitamin D, which was beautiful. It was perfect. And I asked him, what are you doing? And he wasn't taking any vitamin D, but he was in the sun every day. And he told me, well, I only bathe once or twice a week.
Okay,
I thought, well, our great-grandparents who bathed on right. Saturday before that's, Sunday church, yeah, they knew something. So.
That's always been a saying. We take a bath on Saturday night. We've heard that.
One more thing on vitamin D. If your doctor is checking it, the lab level that says normal on the paperwork so that it's not flagged or highlighted, if you're above 30, they'll call you normal. And that's okay. I mean, it's better than being in the teens like a lot of my patients are. But really, the studies show basically a level of 30 is going to prevent rickets. But there's all these other diseases. The research shows that if you get your vitamin D high enough, you can avoid these other diseases potentially, like MS and cancer and heart attacks and diabetes. So I like a level of 50 or above. For cancer patients and heart patients, 70 or above.
Really?
Up to 100 is totally fine on your blood levels. So just look at your number. Even if your doctor says it's normal at 30, I would still consider pushing it to 50 or higher.
When we let's take this break, Doctor, and let me can we pursue that just one more minute when we come back? I'd like to ask you reference what we should ask our doctors.
Okay.
Stay with us, everybody. A great show. I'm just excited to get set in 2 weeks in a row. So stay with us. We got more good stuff to come. We're sitting in with Dr. Ben Edwards today, and I'm glad Wade let me sit in with Dr. Edwards the second week in a row. And it's as enjoyable as something, anything I've done in a long time, Doctor, and I mean that sincerely.
Well, thank you.
To blow smoke up your coattails or anything like that.
Well, but thanks, Jim.
Is it Veritas Medical? Is that the way you...
Veritas.
Veritas.
V as in Victor, E-R-I-T-A-S. And what
Veritas.
That is, when I was first learning all this, just like, you know, scurvy is a deficiency of vitamin C and rickets is a deficiency of vitamin D. Once I learned, and I had another integrative doctor tell me, Ben, there's no diseases. There's no such thing as a disease. They're all consequences. Mm-hmm. Just like scurvy was a quote-unquote disease, but really it was just a consequence of a lack of something, we figured out it was vitamin C. So now there's no more scurvy. But what he was saying is all these quote-unquote diseases are simply a lack of something or an overexposure to something else. A lack of a nutrient God intended us to have or a lack of oxygen like we talked about last week or an overexposure, something God never intended our body to be exposed to very much of. So it's simply that these functional medicine doctors understand the body can heal itself. These are all consequences. We name them diseases. Like rheumatoid arthritis, I was going to mention. We had a 59-year-old gentleman from Childress. I was seeing him in follow-up on Friday. This is why it's fresh on my mind. He first saw us on October 28th of 2014. On the day he walked into our office, he had rheumatoid arthritis was a diagnosis he had been given, although they had bounced around the thought of maybe psoriatic arthritis too, but RA, rheumatoid arthritis, is what they settled on. He was on sulfasalazine, allopurinol, methotrexate and Remicade, along with a few other medicines for some unrelated conditions. So those are big time, powerful, powerful medications to basically shut off the immune system's response to something. The immune system was flared up, turned on, chewing up his joints, and we label it rheumatoid arthritis. But today, he's on none of those medications. In fact, he's on zero medications, and his joint pain is totally resolved. His fingers that used to be, you know, kind of crooked and he couldn't function, couldn't grip. Kind of like Jim's.
I don't mind showing it.
He could barely grip his steering wheel. On Friday, he just made a complete fist back and forth. But the interesting thing he told me, he said, you know, Doc, this is great. I feel great. I feel better than I ever have. My joints are perfect. I'm off all these high-powered medicines. But he said, I was out of town for 9 weeks on business. And I don't know where he was, but he couldn't eat just right, which just right means lots of vegetables, clean meats, nuts, seeds, eggs, some dark berries here and there, basically limiting your grains and your sugars. But he said, you know, 9 weeks, I got a little bit off on that diet, and that joint pain started coming back, and I could already see swelling in my knuckles. And as soon as I got home, I got back to my clean eating, pain went right away. I mean, disappeared again. So, I mean, a beautiful example of someone walking in the door on tons of medications because he's not getting to the root of why his immune system's turned on. Once he did get to the root of that and he removed that thing that was stimulating his immune system to attack his joints, then the immune system turned itself off. He didn't need Remicade to turn off the immune system. It turned itself off. Yeah. So the point is, when he got back on the wrong diet, the pain started coming back. He got back on the right diet, it went away. And it seems too simple, and that's why it's so hard for so many doctors to understand. But it breaks my heart. I was watching CBS Sunday Morning yesterday, and there's a little girl on there with juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. And the point of the show was how Humira. The medication is so costly, and what are we going to do about these high-cost miracle drugs? And that poor little girl, she was overweight. She just looked sick, even though her joint pain was better. And it's better because, just like Remicade and Humira, those medicines shut the immune system off. So if you shut the immune system off, you're not going to have inflammation. So your joints aren't going to be big, red, swollen, and painful and tender and all that. So she can run around and play kickball and basketball because she has shut down the immune system. Therefore, she has no inflammation. The problem is when you have a shut down immune system, you're going to have a lot of consequences from that. Right. There's going to be a lot of bugs that are going to be able to get into you. There's going to be cancer that's going to be able to get you.
Shut down the immune system.
Yes.
Basically means shut down
the immune
system. I mean,
God gave us an immune system for a reason. Mm-hmm. And when it can't be fully functional, you're going to be at more risk for lots of different things. And that's why you see all the potential side effects at the end of the commercials for all these high-powered drugs. But it broke my heart because I don't know for sure what her situation is and what her story is, but I bet if she'd come to our clinic and we could go back to her birth history, which is where we start, what was mom's health like preconception, conception, 9 months of carrying that child, and then all the way through the birth, the school age, all the way up to wherever the patient is today, whether they're 60 years old or 12 years old like that little girl. We take that entire history because we're going to be like a detective. I know you used to be a policeman. Mm-hmm. The more evidence, the more circumstantial stuff, the more people you talk to, the more the story you can get, you start put the pieces of the puzzle together, and you can trace things back. And even though we're here today, we can look back and say, well, here's probably what happened 10 years ago or 5 years ago or 1 year ago or whatever. That's what we do in our clinic. We spend 2 hours with a new patient because we have to ask all these questions and put the pieces together to figure out where is the deficiency or where is the overexposure.
Right.
Because it's one of those two things that's causing that juvenile rheumatoid arthritis in that young lady. Just like Mr. I almost said his name, but the 59-year-old gentleman from Childress, who is symptom-free today, even though he was on Remicade and methotrexate and aspirin and sulfasalazine. There potentially can be a root cause to these things. Mm-hmm. And in medical school, we were talking about this off the air. In medical school, we are not taught about root causes, except on scurvy, rickets, but all the modern diseases that we haven't. I mean, if you really think about the epidemic of obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, heart attack, stroke, even cancer, these are modern diseases. These are 50 to 100-year-old diseases. They were very, very rarely seen in the populations pre-100 years ago. And so in medical school, though, we're not being taught how to dig down to a root cause. We're taught how to treat a symptom. We're taught how to label a patient with a diagnosis and then go to your drug book and pick the drug that fits those symptoms or fits that label. I think I've talked about this on there before, too. Chest pain is a great example. Someone walks in the clinic with chest pain, we're going to ask a bunch of questions, run a few labs, maybe an EKG, to basically classify that chest pain as cardiac chest pain or gastrointestinal chest pain from reflux. And that's it. Once you get your label, then you can prescribe your drugs to manage that problem. And that's the whole issue, is we're taught in medical school how to manage chronic disease. So we're disease managers. We're not disease resolvers mm-hmm. or cures. We really don't cure anybody. In medical school, we're just not taught. So when you go to your doctor and you ask him for a vitamin D level or a vitamin C level or a B12 level or any mineral level, they will probably blow you off. And the reason is not because they're mean or they're being ugly to you or what. They're not just whatever. They're not taught these things.
Well, we talked about that off mic, and that's one of the things I ask you. And you said, you're right, you're not taught those things. You're taught the
pharmaceutical.
Yeah. And you come out of med school, you're on top cloud nine, and you know everything you're supposed to know.
You walk out of that door with your diploma in your hand thinking, pretty much I just learned all there is to know. Well, not totally, because you have internship in the residency.
Sure.
But for sure, after residency, I mean, you're pretty much thinking, you know, I learned all there is to know. Now I just have to go apply it. So if there was something beneficial for my patient, something else that was beneficial to my patient, such as diet, nutrition, vitamins, minerals, then medical school would have taught me. That's the mindset. You come out thinking, if there's something more beneficial, I would have learned it. So if I didn't learn it, it must not be true. Or they would have taught me. That's the mindset. So your docs are thinking in that box that I learned it all. And if I don't know it, then it must not be true. So when you ask them a question about nutrition or diet or lifestyle type stuff, they're either going to wing it, bluff it, or just blow it off and say, well, it's not that big of a deal. Take a one-a-day vitamin, which those one-a-day vitamins are basically worthless. I mean, they're synthetic formulations of a vitamin that needs to be a natural form. But
they're a pharmaceutical vitamin.
Basically, yeah. So it's an unfortunate circumstance. Medical education does not value nutrition. And I think it stems back to...
Don't you think we're going that way more? We're trying?
I think we have to. And part of the have to is because patients are sick enough. They're demanding it. They're having to look outside the box. The people that come to us, for the most part, tell us, you're my last hope. I've been everywhere. I've tried everything. The results are awful, and I'm dying. You're my last hope. So we're kind of this Hail Mary pass that they're trying at the end of the game. But there's more and more of that at younger and younger ages, and it's because the medical system's producing doctors that don't know how to get to the root cause, and if you can't get to the root cause, the patients are going to continue to have symptoms. As you add more and more medications in, the medications interact, those cause more symptoms, and so more people are going to seek out an alternative answer to the conventional solutions that are being offered. So functional medicine is the fastest growing specialty in America right now.
Can I ask you one quick question? I'm sorry, I'm jumping off.
No, good.
Rheumatoid arthritis and fibromyalgia.
Yep.
What's the difference?
Well, fibromyalgia is more pain in the muscles, where rheumatoid arthritis is going to be pain and inflammation of the joints. And that's the main difference, muscles versus joints. But it's the same thing at the root, which is inflammation.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, inflammation is at the root of every disease. It's obvious with rheumatoid arthritis and fibro because there's pain and sometimes swelling and redness and all that of your joints on rheumatoid. So that's very obvious inflammation. Less obvious to people is that coronary artery disease, heart attack, stroke, that at the root is inflammation. The conventional medicine says this. The research says this. Depression at the root is inflammation of the brain. All the gut diseases, Crohn's and ulcerative colitis and IBS, celiac, all that is inflammation. Hypertension is inflammation of the artery. Everything. Cancer. Cancer is a disease of inflammation. So just Google whatever your disease is or your symptom is, and put next to that term, that word, inflammation, and search that on the internet, and you'll see a million hits. Because every disease, every symptoms that we know of now is related to inflammation, just about 98% of them. So the question should be, where does inflammation come from? Well, that comes from the immune system. I've touched on this throughout the show. The immune system turns on, and when it turns on, it's just like the Marines and the Navy SEALs and the Air Force and the Army Rangers. They're out there with their bullets and flamethrowers and grenades and bazookas and rocket launchers. All that, your immune system, when it turns on, it uses cytokines and histamines and leukotrienes. These are chemical weapons of mass destruction. The body uses these chemicals to fight. Well, the problem is, that's fine. If you have a little tiny germ like strep or flu that came into your body momentarily and you turn on to fight it and you wipe it out and you're done and you turn off those weapons of mass destruction in a day or two or three, the problem is when the immune system is chronically turned on every single day, month after month after month after year, the immune system is turned on fighting something. You're in this chronic state of inflammation, results in all these different symptoms, and we label them a disease and we manage it with a drug. So what we should be doing is asking, why is that immune system turned on? Why are the Marines and Army Rangers turned on and told to go fight? Mm-hmm. So that's what we do in functional medicine. We try to figure out what's turning that immune system on and get rid of it. It's pretty simple. It turns out that the problem tends to be nutrition-based, gut-based, or toxin-based. Mm-hmm. And the enemy troops just keep on coming gut. And so we can never totally eradicate them. So we just end up in a state of chronic inflammation. Mm-hmm. So it's unfortunate. We're wasting all our healthcare dollars chasing this and managing it. And it's going to be a long, slow journey, I'm afraid, to turn this big battleship around in the ocean and go do a U-turn the other way. But we're doing it little by little.
Well, I'll tell you what. From all I've heard just in the last 2 weeks, as I was telling you, Dr. Edwards, just thanks, Wade, for letting me do this 2 weeks in a row. I have thoroughly enjoyed it. Like, if we keep talking, we're going to be kinfolks. We've already figured that out. Kinfolks somewhere down the line. But, yeah, I know, it's fun, but it's been great, and so much knowledge in here and so much things we need to look at that we've, especially people our age, it's just the opposite of what we've been, you know. We started out that way years ago, of course, but then, you know, medicine.
Well, the drug companies came in, and they're great if you do choose to manage stuff. We can manage. I mean, we can put you on a lot of drugs and keep that leaky tire patched up, and you can get down the road with that.
You can put a Band-Aid on it.
Yeah, and there's something to say for that as opposed to not doing anything. I mean, I'd rather you manage it, but the results of that, you need to know, are going to be less quality of life and probably less life in general.
Absolutely.
And spending a whole lot more time, energy, and money at the doctor's office and at the drugstore.
Oh.
Where the alternative to that would be get to the root of it and fix it. You know, pull your tire off, fix the hole, put it back on, and you're done. You don't have to deal with the leaky tire by just filling up the air every few days like I used to do on one of my tires.
Maybe get tire mixed. We're fixed to start visiting. I can see that coming. I really mean that very sincerely. Dr. Ben Edwards, tell them how to get a hold of you, my good friend.
Oh, the best is our website, veritasmedical.com. V as in Victor, E-R-I-T-A-S, medical.com. Phone number is 771-1160.